We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. This appears to be a new regular feature, at least for a while. Another passing of a very notable nationally recognized writer.
Yeah, Barbara.
Aaron Reich.
Yeah, Aaron Reich, who wrote Nickel and Dimes along with many, many other books over the last half century, passed away yesterday at age 81. There was no cause of death given. But she was remarkably consistent in her advocacy for the non-rich, for people who don't show up in American media and are not valued by American media because, you know, advertisers don't want them, but who are struggling from paycheck to paycheck. And Nickel and Dime, which is her most famous book, which came out in the early 2000s, she went out and reported on that, took a number of low-wage jobs and reported what it was like trying to make ends meet on those jobs. That, of course, is certainly timely now, especially in our larger cities where even having a place to live is virtually unaffordable for a lot of folks. And she was consistently advocating for those issues and for addressing income inequality, et cetera, all the way through the last couple of years when she got into her 80s. So will be missed terribly.
Yeah, Aaron Reich was a model for me when I was a young activist, just kind of getting interested in activism and politics. I read her her book Fear of Falling, which I think she published, I want to say, back in the late 80s, early 90s, long before she did Nickel and Dimed. It looked at the reason why so many lower and middle income, particularly middle income Americans, can be very conservative, and why they're always thinking, you know, rather than supporting collective action, thinking in terms of individual action and hoping to climb the income ladder, but always being driven by this fear of falling, and becoming poorer. It's a very, very interesting book. And, what I really took away from it is that women can research and write about very serious political topics. And back in the 80s and 90s, that wasn't as common as it is today. A lot more women do that now than did back then. And she was one of the folks who really inspired me to write and to talk about these issues and be very serious about it. So I will miss her for sure.
And she had a wonderful, wicked sense of humor, too.
She did. And in addition to writing great books, she also wrote articles and political commentary that was very entertaining to read as well as very informative.
And that often showed up in publications that don't have a lot of that, like the New York Times or the Washington Post, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, she had mainstream access because of her success as an author. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very few people on the left have that. So she'll be missed for that reason, too.
Mm-hmm. Big shoes to fill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which seems to be true of so many people who have passed this last year.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And even in the last month with, you know, Jean Darcy and Dorley Rayner.
Let's move on. I know the Kent teachers are still on strike, but it's Seattle teachers are looking to go on strike this next week.
Yes, the first day of school in the Seattle School District is this coming Wednesday, September 7th. The Seattle Education Association, the Seattle Teachers Union, is currently negotiating a new contract with the Seattle School District, but there's been no announcement yet of any agreement, and the two sides appear to be separated on some key issues. And earlier this week, the Seattle Education Association Board voted to ask the membership to vote on granting the board the ability to call a strike if the school district doesn't agree on a new contract in time for the school year to start. So voting on that strike authorization started on Thursday, And voting will go on through the weekend, and it will close at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, September 6th. And then the Seattle Education Association Board will sit down and count the votes, and they will announce on Tuesday what, excuse me, and they will keep trying to negotiate with the Seattle School District. By Tuesday, they should know whether or not they can call a strike. And they have already said if the members vote to allow them to call a strike, that it looks like it's very possible that could happen next week. The Seattle Teachers Union is asking for higher pay. With the current starting base pay is $63,000 for a teacher in Seattle. Now, remember, the median income in Seattle currently is $120,907. Okay. So starting base pay is at 52% of median income, just barely above half of median income, which would qualify a lot of young teachers for low-income housing here in Seattle, right? And other types of programs that are geared towards the working poor. Okay. Now, the highest base pay rate for teachers in Seattle is $123,000. So even veteran teachers make just barely above median income. Okay. Now, the teachers union is also asking for reasonable workloads and class sizes, including adding a student to teacher calculation to the contract. And that's something that the school district opposes and is pushing back on.
Well, that.
Yeah. The union is also asking for the district to commit to special education and multilingual education to avoid making any cuts to those programs and to add staff so that special ed and multilingual students can spend more time in general classrooms, which usually means that those students need additional staff to help them integrate into those classes. But of course, the school district doesn't want to commit to hiring that extra staff, so they're also pushing back on some of that. In addition, the teachers union wants English as a second language programs added to more schools so that those kids can go to their neighborhood schools instead of having to bus to one or two schools in the city that provide good ESL programs. So those are the main sticking points in the contract. And it's so far it's looking like the Seattle School District is not wanting to do those things. And we could see a strike next week.
Okay, moving on. Bruce Harrell getting some extra attention this week.
Now we know why he doesn't like to open his mouth.
Yeah. Now, he's been going on a little tour of the police precincts around the city and speaking at the morning roll calls at those precincts in order to, you know, boost morale. That's his rationale. To me, it sounds like he's doing it in order to get political support from the police union.
Yeah, but I think of it as campaign stops, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's more that he's just way more comfortable speaking to cops than he is speaking to just about anybody else. But in his tour of police precincts, he's apparently been bad-mouthing the city council and the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Now, this was reported by a local right-wing journalist, so I'm not going to say that these comments are absolutely accurate, but that journalist said that he actually listened to recorded comments that members that police officers let him watch of these speeches and these talks that Harrell had given. And these are some of the comments that this journalist wrote down and added to his own article. And some of the comments included things like this comment about the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Harrell said, quote, "I'm funding them 70%, over $118 million, and I have no control over them. I'm one of nine on the board." And so I just want to say about that quote that that's false. The city is funding them, not Bruce Harrell himself. The city council actually voted on that funding. And the amount is not $118 million. It's $69 million. Harrell happens to be including the federal COVID-19 relief funds that went to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And I just want to point out that that is not his money. All right. That's federal funding and it's taxpayer money. Now, another quote that was in the article was that Harrell said that he might cut the funding for King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And this is a direct quote. I didn't set this stuff up. I get one vote out of nine and they criticize my removal efforts. So I'm funding an organization that seems to be working against what I'm trying to do, end quote. So I just want to unpack that for a second. I want to say, Mr. Mayor, you didn't set up the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. That's true. But you voted for it when you were a council member. So yeah, you did help set it up. Okay.
Oh, and details, then, details.
Yeah. And then secondly, I want to say I really hate to break it to you, Mr. Mayor, but getting one vote out of nine is how democracy works. Okay. and then thirdly, I want to remind Mayor Harrell that you are not funding them. Okay. Taxpayers are funding the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And finally, Mr. Mayor, you really shouldn't call encampment sweeps removals. That really sounds like a type of word that the Nazis would have used. Really sounds like a right wing Nazi, almost Nazi like euphemism. Okay. So there's a third quote.
It's a final solution.
Yeah.
I would also mention before you move on to the next quote His griping about having only one vote out of nine on council
belies homelessness authority. Yeah.
Yeah. Belies the fact that as city council president, not only did he set the agenda, but he did so in probably the most authoritarian manner of any city council president in recent memory. He very much wanted to run city council as though it were his.
When he was city council president, yeah.
Yes, he was the worst city council president we've had in ages, and unfortunately,
he was very hands off, I think, and it really really made me concerned when he ran for mayor that he wouldn't be a competent mayor. Because I didn't really feel like he understood how to run a large organization.
And he was very hostile to public input.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that during the whole, head tax debate. He had no patience whatsoever for public process. And, frankly, that's one of his weakest spots as mayor as well. He wants to run the city as though it's his private fiefdom.
Yeah.
And you can't do that in a democracy either.
Yeah. So the third comment I want to talk about is, after complaining that he wished he had that $118 million back, it was actually 69 or 118 million back. It was actually 69 million, but, details.
What's 49 million between friends?
right.
Especially when it's taxpayer money.
Right. He complained that, he would have spent it on his quote unquote public safety strategy, which I have to point out appears to be non-existent other than his plan to hire more police, which is actually happening. I should point out his the little tiny step that appears to be his entire public safety strategy is actually happening. And the city council did actually fund it. Right. Harrell went on to moan. And quote, no one has a right to camp out in a park where our children are supposed to play. I'm not supposed to see freaking syringes in a park, end quote. So my immediate response to that is, so fund a safe consumption site already. Okay.
And my immediate response to it is nobody has a right to commit sexual assaults either.
Yeah. Even though he went to bat for Ed Murray on that. Oh my God. So I looked at that.
I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking of, that's true too, but I was thinking of, the fact that SPD wasn't investigating sexual assaults for most of these here.
True.
Because
yeah.
They moved their personnel to homeless sweeps.
Yes, instead, exactly. Yes, you know, exactly.
Because, you know, syringes in park are apparently a worse thing than committing sexual assault. That's just fine.
And then my second response to that quote was after thinking, okay, well, you know, there's a real easy way to get rid of needles in parks, and that's to have safe consumption sites so people don't have to hide under a bush to manage a drug habit. And as we know, drug addiction is not something that you can just kick by a little bit of willpower. Okay. The second thing that I thought was, okay, so, you know, instead of using that $69 million to hire more cops and do more encampment sweeps, why are we not building more public housing so that folks camping out in the park have a stable home to go to that isn't going to double the rent on them in 6 months? Okay. Why aren't we funding more treatment programs? Because currently the city's not funding nearly enough treatment programs for people who have addictions. Okay. So there's, you know, a real simple response to that, that of course Harold can't think his way through, way to. Okay. And then there's a fourth quote that I wanted to address too. Harold also complained
that it's just keep on coming.
Oh, they keep on coming. Yeah. He also complained about people who do actually have a public safety strategy. This is the quote, "We're looking at people who provide services, lead service downtown, see what's working, what's just BS. We're really trying to rewrite the script," end quote. And my response is, rewrite the script to do what? To put out more BS, like your public safety strategy? I mean, Seattle's brand new conservative city attorney, who I'm guessing is best buddies with Bruce Harrell, is currently referring a historically high number of people to lead community court and other diversion programs because they work. Okay. Even the Seattle police have complained that the city doesn't fund enough resources for lead and that they would like to be able to refer more people to those programs. Okay.
Whatever happened to data-driven policies?
I know. So I really don't understand what Bruce Harrell meant there, except that maybe he's just that out of touch. Okay.
He is that out of touch, and he's not nearly as smart as he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a fifth quote.
Thank God.
After complaining that not a single local Democrat supported his candidacy, Harrell singled out the city council. This is the quote. Quote, "A couple of them, their resumes are quite thin. I say that as a nice way to say that they're inexperienced," end quote. And I looked at that and I kind of laughed because the most inexperienced of the current city council members is Sarah Nelson, who most vociferously supports Bruce Harrell's agenda. Okay.
Yeah. And she's by far the most conservative member of council.
Yeah. And quite obviously the one that really doesn't know how city government works. You can tell that by a lot of her comments. But really, I think
she's in way over her head, honestly.
Yeah. But really, well, yeah, she's got a super steep learning curve and is only sort of partially scaling it at this point. But I think what Harrell was doing, what he was thinking in that moment, was that he was criticizing Andrew Lewis, who keeps pushing Harrell's staff at every opportunity to get a new civilian 911 responder team up and running. Literally, Andrew Lewis does not let an opportunity go by without making some kind of comment and pushing for that. Harrell's staff so far have been really agreeable with that, and they think it's a really good idea, but obviously nothing is happening, and nothing's really coming down from the mayor to move that along. And now we can really see that it's not Harrell's staff that is dragging their feet. It's Bruce Harrell himself who doesn't agree that that's the way to go, and he's the one that's pushing back. I think we can see that quite obviously with these comments. So the pressure should be on him in particular to get that done.
Okay.
Now,
is there a number six?
There is a number six. There's one final quote. Just, you know, I mean, there's more, but I'm just going to do one final one here because we only have so much time. Bruce Harrell really exposed his own work in trying to unseat current city council members and local municipal court judges with this quote. And it starts this way. Quote, quite frankly, I'm working on the city council races. 7 are up next year. I'm looking at people running for office. I'm talking to the judges about some of their policies, and we're looking at those races. Like I say, politics. I know politics, and this is not child's play. In order to get the city on the right track, I have to be that tenacious. You don't see mayors doing that. I've already talked to 2 potential candidates for city council, end quote. And I saw that.
In order to make an omelet, you have to crack a few eggs.
Yes, yes. And he's right. You don't see mayors doing that typically, unless you're talking about big corrupt political machines backed by organized crime. Or the next big, or the next best thing, really, which is backed by huge corporations, right? So
same thing.
Yeah, I think pretty clearly we need to be tenacious when the next election comes around, and then the election after that when Harrell is up for for office again. By looking at these quotes, which is the secret Bruce Harrell and what he actually thinks about city politics, I have to say I think he's going to be yet another one-term mayor in Seattle.
I think so, too. When he was on city council for a decade, I always thought of him as a thug, honestly.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's changed.
Yeah, I don't think he's changed at all. Also this week, Harrell shifted his public safety czar, Andrew Meyerberg, to a new position, having to do with quote-unquote special projects, whatever that means. And that could be because Meyerberg hasn't really developed a public safety strategy for Harrell, maybe. Maybe it's because Meyerberg agrees with Andrew Lewis about civilian 911 responders, and Harrell is virulently against that. Who knows? Harrell said he would appoint a new public safety czar later this month when he announces his pick for the new Seattle police chief. So we can expect that we'll find out who that person is. My guess, probably someone who is less conciliatory than Andrew Meyerberg.
Why do we need a public safety czar?
It was one of Harrell's promises, which is why I didn't vote for him.
So, I still don't understand why it's necessary.
No, I know. I don't either. And he didn't adequately explain it, but it was a great soundbite for people who wanted to take the city in a more conservative pro-police direction.
So I'm trying to think this through, and I'm having a hard time. there's no job description. And he didn't like what Meyerberg didn't do in a position with a new job description. There's a problem here, and I don't think it's in the person holding the position of public safety czar. I think it's in its boss, honestly.
Yes, yes, I do. I do too. I think Harrell wants that public safety czar, as I said, to be less conciliatory and more, pro police and crack down on the homeless and prosecute more people in court, et cetera. And I think Ann Davison probably would fill the bill for him. But unfortunately, in a city that has a lot of people in the Democratic Party establishment who are just not that conservative, he's having a tough time finding somebody to fill that slot.
I want people prosecuted too. I want people who commit sexual assaults to be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But first they have to be investigated, don't they?
Oh, priorities.
Yeah.
right.
Oh my God, there's a syringe in my park.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
So don't step on it. Seriously.
Hey, well, yeah. Speaking of parks.
Yes.
Harrell Speaking also of parks, had a announcement this week.
Yeah, in July, the Seattle Parks District Board discussed and decided to support a renewal of the parks levy that would double funding for Seattle parks. The new levy proposal would raise $108 to $115 million per year and the average household in Seattle would pay about $307 per year in taxes versus $155 under the current levy. That average household being, you know, somebody who makes $120,000 a year. So not a high burden for them.
Boy, am I below median income.
Yes. Now, this week, Mayor Harrell released a list of projects that the new levy would fund, including upgrading park facilities, keeping 129 of the city's restrooms open all year round instead of closing them all in the winter, expanding hours at community centers, removing graffiti, fixing vandalized facilities as vandalism occurs, adding more staff to keep facilities clean overnight and on weekends, decarbonizing 6 community centers and park facilities, planting a lot more trees, and opening 12 new parks that would add more than 10 new acres of parkland to the city's parks. Instead of sending the levy to voters, of course, the levy will go to the Seattle Parks District Board, which is made up of all 9 members of the city council. They will consider and vote on the levy in an upcoming meeting. Now, that's the funding side of it. Harrell introduced the spending side of it, which is going to be included in his city budget that he's expected to release the first draft of later this month. Now, if you remember back, and I just want to see. I just want to say, if you remember back in 2014, voters approved an initiative for a new citywide parks district and gave the new Seattle Parks District Board, made up of the city council, the ability to levy a property tax of up to 75 cents per 1,000 assessed value. This new levy would take that tax to 38 cents per 1,000 assessed value. So now, that's why the levy is not going to voters to vote on.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the last time we had a levy, I remember there being a kerfuffle because the same thing in advance of the vote, which that time was the voters, they released a list of all the marvelous things that the new levy would fund. And then they didn't really follow through on any of them. Or they changed the list, you know, dramatically after the vote. So I seem to remember that. Maybe I'm remembering wrong. But if that's true, then this kind of a list now is not binding at all.
Well, I don't recall that being the kerfuffle. I recall the idea of giving the city council the ability to raise property taxes of up to 75 cents and the conservative folks saying, oh, they'll levy the maximum as soon as they possibly can. And I just want to point out that they're not anywhere near the maximum rate yet. They're barely at half.
Yeah. They're only doubling the old rate.
The old rate, which was about a quarter of the max of the levy lid. So
you're still going to hear the anti-tax folks, you know, pitch a fit over this.
Yeah. And it's important to remember, too, that since 2014, that the city parks have been used like nothing else during the pandemic, because that's the one safe place people could go to get out of the house.
And not only that, but since 2014, mm-hmm. Seattle has added an enormous amount of population. And,
yes, that
you know,
is true.
Our parks have not kept pace with that at all.
In addition, there was actually a presentation by the Seattle Parks Department to the City Council committee that oversees the parks that talked about some of the challenges that the Parks Department has had in terms of dealing with a record number of homeless people. And having to spend money routinely on collecting garbage and cleaning, also a record amount of vandalism. So really, in a sense, we talk about Seattle police. There's a lot of talk about Seattle police having the burden of trying to be social workers. There's not as much talk about the Seattle parks employees and parks personnel having to also fill that role and having to also do maintenance, not just for the parks themselves, but for people who don't have a home. And think about, too, if you have parks where the restrooms are being used, not just during the day and on particularly on weekends when the public tend to be there, but being used 24/7 by homeless people as well, the facilities just go through a lot more wear and tear.
Yeah.
So there's all.
And you want them using those restrooms because the alternative
is going really, under a bush or, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Something worse. So, yeah.
With current policy, the closing the restrooms during the winter, it's like, oh yeah, we can hold it. You know,
we're gonna hold up for 6 months.
Yeah, that was a big issue. That's been a big issue at the city council is trying to keep restrooms open throughout the year. And the parks department personnel said, well, there are challenges with that because you have to spend money to winterize those. Otherwise you end up with frozen pipes and broken fixtures that freeze and break. So that requires money. And that means you can't do other things like replace old and aging park facilities, which are already in the budget. So that's some of the challenges that the Parks Department have had and that we need to keep in mind when we think about, well, where are the new parks we were promised under the old levy, right? There are these new and unforeseen costs that have not been talked about as much as the issues that Seattle police have had with dealing with homeless and folks who need mental health treatment, et cetera. So that's coming down the pike, the new levy.
So we'll be keeping an eye on that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Meanwhile, it is now September, and that means Sound Transit's going to start fare enforcement again?
Yeah, Sound Transit has voted. Now, I should point out that King County Metro is still not doing fare enforcement. They're still operating under a pandemic model that is meant to encourage people to ride if they absolutely don't have a car and have to get to their jobs, but isn't going to penalize poor people if they can't afford bus fare during a time in which many people either don't have a job or they don't have enough hours to pay for their living expenses, right? But the Sound Transit Board discussed several different options, including maybe making light rail free for all riders, which would continue the trend from when they suspended fare enforcement at the start of the pandemic, right? But instead, they voted to begin a new fare enforcement program. Now, remember, the old program involved Sound Transit hiring outside security thugs to board about 8% of their trains and go passenger by passenger and demand to see tickets or ORCA cards. And if they found someone who either didn't have a ticket or refused to show their ticket or card, then the thugs would demand to see an ID and issue that person a $124 citation and or ban them from riding light rail. Now, an audit showed that even though Black residents of Seattle make up about 9% of light rail users, they received 22% of the citations. There's some racial inequity there. Homeless people received between 25 to 30% of citations, which, of course, were never paid. In spite of former Sound Transit CEO Peter Rogoff's assertion that 30% of riders didn't pay, fare enforcers routinely reported that 95% of the people they asked to show payment could show proof of payment. Okay, so instead of 30%, it was actually around 5%, which of course led to the question of why is Sound Transit punishing people for being poor by issuing $124 citations or banning them from the only mode of transportation they could take when they couldn't afford to drive, right? Sound Transit estimates that it's currently losing about $100 million per year from riders who aren't paying because of the pandemic policy to spare fare enforcement. Okay, and that's debatable. But here's the deal. Sound Transit also estimates that the new fare enforcement policy program will cost the agency about $672 million over the next 20 years or so, and probably a lot more than that, once the system begins to expand to the east side to Bellevue, Issaquah, Redmond, et cetera, and further north to Linwood. In 2019, just before the pandemic shutdown, fares paid for about 38% of operating costs. Okay. So it's not like Sound Transit is losing the bulk of their funding for operating costs, right? And Sound Transit is investing a lot of money and effort to collect, from the city's poorest riders, money that will only cover about 11% of its annual operating costs. Okay. Now the new fare enforcement officers, instead of being called, I don't know, security thugs.
That was not their official title, by the way.
Yeah, fare enforcement officers. They will be officially called ambassadors. And they won't be handing out $124 citations anymore. Instead, they will ask to see proof of payment. And if you can't produce that, then they will want to see your ID, even though there is currently a lawsuit working its way through towards the state Supreme Court over that, whether or not people are required to show their ID to private security or to these fare enforcement ambassadors.
And bear in mind that students use light rail a lot.
Yes.
And they often don't have state-issued IDs, and they shouldn't need them.
Yeah, underage students, 18 and younger. Now, yes. If you don't have proof of payment, the quote unquote ambassadors will ask to see your ID. They'll want to take down your name, and they'll give you a warning and offer to help you load money on an Orca card. They're not supposed to actually kick you off the light rail, but it's not clear to me what they will do if you refuse to show them your ID. And any proof of payment. If you just tell them, get out of my face, right? You know, get out of here. It's not clear to me what they will do in that situation. And I'm guessing we're going to find out. And it's not going to be pretty. One thing is really clear to me. Sound Transit's going to be spending a lot of money on this program, but they won't be collecting any new revenue, really, from the fare ambassadors, right? If they're not issuing citations, there's no money coming in, but there's a heck of a lot of money going to be spent on this program. What is the trade-off? I mean, what is the reason for it? If you're spending all this money, you're just harassing poor people and you're not collecting any fares from it.
Yeah.
And we know that the old fare enforcement program, even with issuing the citations, didn't really collect much money either, because most people just didn't pay the citations, because for one thing, they didn't have the money because they were issued to people who just don't have any money, right? So again, it's the question of why even bother with a program if it's not going to bring in any income and it's just a form of harassment. So yes, we'll see.
All right, moving on. Ruling this week against Facebook, at least locally.
Regionally. Yes. King County Superior Court Judge Douglas North ruled this week that Meta, the parent company of Facebook, repeatedly and intentionally, violated Washington state law governing political advertising. In 2008.
Now, this is me doing a Snoopy happy dance, by the way.
Yes, this is good news. In 2018, Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued Facebook and Google for not complying with Washington State campaign financing law, which says that all media companies must disclose to the public the names of people, groups, or companies who paid for a political ad, who the target of the ad is, and how many people have viewed or actually been sent the ad. So, for example, in a newspaper, you just disclose your circulation on that day that the ad ran, right? Now, or if you're a TV station, you would say, okay, we think we have this many viewers who saw this ad on this day. Now, this law has been on the books for about 50 years here in Washington State. Google said that they would stop running ads in Washington State. Facebook, in 2018, admitted guilt. They paid their fines and also said that they would stop running ads in Washington. but Facebook has run at least 728 ads since then without disclosing the necessary information under Washington law. And some of those ads were run during the 2019 City Council campaign, Seattle City Council campaigns, but also affected campaigns in Tacoma, Vancouver, and Spokane, Washington.
And if you are running a political campaign, you know, very often social media advertising is really attractive. It's relatively inexpensive per eyeball, and you can target your audience very effectively because, of course, Facebook, that's what they do, is they collect what are called
analytics, really demographic information about who their viewers are, but also their viewing habits, what things they click on.
What you buy, because it's, you know, shared with, you know, other corporate vendors. And, you know, the amount of consumer data that Facebook has is just terrifying, honestly. That's what they're in business for.
It's not really.
What they sell is you.
Yes. Access to you and to your eyeballs and to your mind. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson then filed a second suit against Facebook in 2020, seeking the maximum penalty under the law. Each violation can lead to a fine of $10,000, which is tripled if the company intentionally violated the law. Okay. Facebook can't claim, of course, that they didn't know what the law said since they admitted guilt in 2018. So it appears obvious that they intentionally violated the law. Now, this week, the judge not only ruled that Facebook did violate the law, he also ruled that they did so intentionally. In addition, he dismissed Meta's attempt to have the Washington state law ruled invalid. The judge accepted Ferguson's argument that other media companies, print, TV, and radio, have been able to comply with the law for decades. So it's not an unreasonable law, and it's not a violation of free speech under the U.S. Constitution, as Facebook had argued. Judge North will rule on the penalties at a later date, but if he agrees to the triple penalty because he has ruled that Facebook intentionally violated the law, Facebook could be facing more than $20 million in fines owed to the state.
Now, that sounds like a lot, and it's a lot for the state, but it's literally pocket change for a company like Facebook.
Yeah. So my question is, after paying the fine, will Facebook actually stop running ads in Washington state? We'll have to see.
I predict they will not. They will continue doing
just the cost of doing business, allowing their users to violate Washington state campaign law.
And like I say, it's a drop in the bucket for them. Exactly. You know, it is not a significant deterrent. And fines like that are supposed to be deterrents. They would certainly be a deterrent for you and I, but for a company like, you know, Amazon or Facebook or any of the tech companies, I mean, the basically print money, you know, it's just not significant.
Yeah, and it kind of raises the issue of maybe we should have the state legislature increase the fine in that law. Right. Or maybe we should have a citizens' initiative that increases the fine.
And not increase the fine to a set amount, but increase it to a percentage of their annual revenue.
That would be good.
Won't happen, but it's a nice thought.
Yeah, it's a nice thought.
All right. Spokane police officer found guilty of rape.
Yeah, this is a another you know, cops behaving badly episode. A guy named Nathan Nash was found guilty on Tuesday of second degree rape and third degree rape of members of the public while he was on duty. He was also found not guilty of another second degree rape charge and unlawful imprisonment, i.e. kidnapping. Have these numbers of episodes, and you wonder how many others weren't reported because he threatened them or whatever. You know, this is the kind of behavior that has been a problem in Spokane police for a long time, and it's a reminder also that, you know, It's not just Seattle that has law enforcement agency problems. This is a problem with the entire profession. It's a very sad episode, but good that he was found guilty on these charges and will spend a significant part of the rest of his life in jail for them.
All right. Moving on to national news and updates with our former president.
Oh yeah, you want to start in on this, Maria?
Yeah, the FBI.
I'm smiling, by the way.
The FBI releasing a list of documents found at Mar-a-Lago. It's of course you got to kind of ask if Donald Trump has a competent legal team, because each move they make opens the door for further bad news for their side, including the FBI releasing this list of documents.
And we saw a couple of different DOJ court filings later in the week that elaborated on it. One that was a photo of some of the documents seized. And then yesterday we found the 48 empty folders. Mm-hmm. And these were
with classified stamped on them.
Yes.
What was in those folders and where is the contents now?
I would say probably scattered around Moscow and Riyadh. But, these last two items were court filings originally, and court filings in response to Trump legal team moves. So, you know, it's this constant drip, drip, drip of when you think it can't get any worse. Yeah, it's getting worse. And it's getting worse primarily because the Trump legal team keeps filing these ridiculous motions that the DOJ has to respond to with more information. And when they release more information, it's bad for the Trump folks.
Yeah, it just makes it, just seems to be, you know, upping the ante of worse. Yeah. What really stood out to me were the 42 empty folders labeled "Return to Staff Secretary / Military Aid."
Yes.
Okay. And you're like, what military materials and those are empty folders, right?
Well,
what military info was in those folders and where is it now?
Well, we know that, classified documents that have that level of security, the top secret, that probably involves troop movements. Think about that for a second. We don't know where
or your military capability of some kind.
Yes. Yes. And now nuclear documents are separate from military documents in the federal lexicon. But, you really wonder where some of this stuff went. I want to find out if Donald Trump has a PayPal account, and if so, who's been using it? It's like, when the only two things that motivate Trump that anybody has seen, at least in recent years, are ego and money. So did he hold on to these documents because he thought he was still president and was entitled to? Or
did he hold on to them because they were valuable and could be sold or used to barter a loan extension for his personal businesses?
Exactly. Has he been conducting a bidding war with these documents for the last 2 years? I mean, we just don't know.
Yeah.
He's had 18 months with these documents since he's been drummed out of office. And that's a long time. He could have been doing anything with that stuff. But we know that a lot of them were found mixed in with, more pedestrian items in his personal office. So he knew they were there. You really wonder whether the empty folders, the documents that should have been in them, are just mixed up with newspaper clippings somewhere. Because remember, the search warrant for the Mar-a-Lago estate had to specify, locations where the FBI thought the documents were. And they found a lot of documents there. But they did not search the whole estate. It's a large, sprawling compound. And
that was my other thought, is where else might there be?
Yeah, it could have been hidden almost anywhere in the compound, because we know at this point, thanks to court filings, that the Trump people or Trump himself were intentionally trying to hide these documents after they got served subpoenas by the DOJ. So, it's a mess and it's a national security nightmare because, for example, some of the documents involved that were recovered had to do with human intelligence, that is spies on the ground in foreign countries, and also a list of suspected spies of other countries in our country. And also signal intelligence, that is to say, being able to intercept, say, phone calls, emails, etc. So how do you know that that's not in the hands of a foreign adversary? Well, you don't, because, you know, if, you know, the people in, say, Russian or Chinese intelligence are smart, too, and they know those documents might be out there. And if they have it in their possession, they're not necessarily going to tip their hand by going and killing all the American spies immediately. That's what the U.S. is looking for, and that's what the U.S. is looking for signs of in signal intelligence as well. But if you're a foreign intelligence agency, you sit on those documents. You know, you let the U.S. play its hand. You watch where the U.S. spies go.
You feed misinformation to those names that you have, those spies' names.
So this is really a national security and an intelligence nightmare. Because there's really no way to verify who might have that information at this point. But, you know, you certainly can't rely on the word of Donald Trump because he lies the way he breathes, you know, every couple seconds.
So it's kind of interesting. Not all Republicans are behind him on when Trump said, oh, I declassified those documents myself when I left right before I left the White House. Now, Attorney General, his own Attorney General, William Barr, said some interesting things on Fox News this week. And one of them was the specter of Donald Trump or anyone standing over a pile of documents, not knowing what was in them and just waving his hands and saying, I declassify all this, is troubling in and of itself. And kind of hinted that that was a sign of incompetency. Now, he also said things like, here's a direct quote, people say this was unprecedented, but it's also unprecedented for a president to take all this classified information and put them in a country club, okay?
Yeah.
And then he also said that the documents, whether they're classified or not, and this again is a direct quote, still belong to the government and go to the archives, end quote. So and, there and, you have Trump's and, own attorney general saying this and, is wrong.
And the DOJ in the search warrant and the affidavit for it was very careful because the crimes that were specified as the DOJ suspected Trump of and that the judge signed off on don't require that those documents be classified. Trump as president or as especially as former president does not have the authority to unilaterally declassify documents. There's a whole process involved, and the DOJ laid out very carefully that Trump had never claimed that these documents were declassified while he was in office or for the first 18 months while he was out of office. So that he stopped.
Yeah, that
he
was stopped. Never a response to the government's request that he return those documents. He or his, and his legal team never said, oh, by the way, he's declassified these.
Yeah.
They never said that.
So he was saying that in the first few days after the raid, but he's really stopped saying that the last week or two because it basically got laughed out of court, as so many of Trump's motions do.
Yeah, and the other thing I'm hearing, too, is I'm hearing a lot of people, even people on the left, say, well, you know, the documents have been returned, so we don't expect there will be charges filed. And my response is, what? not filing any charges?
A major resort destination.
Some documents have been returned. Some documents have been returned. We don't know if all documents have been returned. And with the revelation this week that there were
there,
my guess is not all documents have been returned and that the government is now under an obligation to file charges to try to get further access to his properties to find out if all documents have been returned. I think that there's absolutely an obligation for the Department of Justice to bring a lawsuit and to go after the entire Trump team.
And I'm going to.
And all of, and search Donald Trump and all of his properties at this
and
point.
And I'm going to take a wild guess that a modern major resort destination, like, which was what Mar-a-Lago is, mm-hmm. Has copy machines and scanners on the premises.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's, come on. You return the documents. That doesn't mean a damn thing. You have to do a damage assessment of what this is.
You have to look at digital document. You have to look at digital.
Yeah.
As well.
You do. And you have to conduct a damage assessment, which Congress is now doing and the intelligence agencies are now doing, of how this impacts U.S. Intelligence efforts and U.S. military efforts. Because this is a national security disaster. I mean, Trump himself is a national security disaster and was as president too. But this is even worse. It's far worse. This is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And I think it's going to land Donald Trump in prison. I honestly do.
Well, I hope so.
It if he were anybody else, it would have already landed them in prison.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
He'd be charged and awaiting trial. There's no question of that.
Yeah. Probably already behind bars.
Yeah.
All right. Just a couple minutes left. Did you want to touch on the Biden speech that occurred this week?
Yeah. I think it's related. Biden had a major speech in Philadelphia Thursday night at which he directly attacked the Republican Party as a threat to democracy.
Well,
now,
a slice of the Republican Party,
yes,
particularly the folks who support Donald Trump.
Yes, but he was very specific that they dominate the Republican Party now. he did try to separate that from Republicans who still believe in democracy. But he was saying, you know, this as a party right now, their policies are they don't believe in democracy. And, you know, to anybody who's been paying attention, this is obvious. I mean, right? This is like saying the sun is rising in the east. It is true. It just is. And, you know, some Republican candidates that we're seeing in this cycle are very explicit about that, honestly, like Blake Masters in Arizona comes to mind. Of course, you know, the Republicans howled, they cried foul, and this is partisan and so forth. And it is partisan because there's only one major political party in the United States right now that believes in democracy, let alone being able to govern. And, you know, Biden was right to call them out, and it was long overdue, honestly.
Yeah, it was helpful that Biden didn't just, you know, it wasn't just name calling. It was saying, look, if you are doing these certain things, if you are challenging the results of election, if you're trying actively to make it harder for certain types of people to vote, you know, if you're trying to throw out legitimate ballots and change a vote count, you know, that it's very, very helpful that he pointed out these activities as anti-democratic and saying,
yes.
And, you know, the Republicans can't deny that they're actively trying to do these things because they are.
And they're proud of it.
Yeah. So I thought that was probably the most helpful thing about it. One of the things that I found really disturbing is that the speech got no coverage on any of the major television networks and very little coverage in newspapers and online websites.
It got coverage, but it was not broadcast.
No.
Which it should have been because it was a presidential speech.
Yeah, it should have been. Whether or not those television networks thought it was a partisan speech or not, it should have at least been broadcast and a discussion done about it.
Yeah.
And it just was not. And I think that's a sign that our TV networks are partisan.
I was going to say an 11-letter word that begins with chicken and ends with tea.
Yes, I agree with that too.